That's resulted in a growing interest in locally grown food and consumers known as locavores. Illinois Public Radio's Jim Brown has this report.
Off of a 1.5-lane blacktop, about 4 miles east of Atlanta, is Prairie Earth Farms. It's hardly noticeable from the road until you see the greenhouses in the backyard. Hans Bishop and his father David decided they'd pursue what's known as a niche in agriculture, in part to break away from chemically dependent practices.
My dad bought it in the early 80s and just kind of wanted to find a way to make a smaller acreage farm work.
Hans starts up a 60-year-old tractor. It's hitched to a flat trailer. He and the other farmhands are tossing garlic pulled from a weedy section of the 300 acres they tend onto the trailer. They also grow wheat, alfalfa, and soybeans, along with other crops, many of which are destined for community-supported agriculture. CSA members buy shares of crops for delivery at harvest. A one-year CSA costs $450. The Bishops originally used traditional farming methods, but Hans says they became disenchanted with the toll the practices were taking on the land.
And that's why we diversified and became organic.
Hans Bishop proudly waves toward weeds amidst the garlic, saying the unwanted plants prove the operation's organic. The Bishops also market their organic produce at farmers' markets. Another way of cultivating money from smaller farms is also showing up. According to the president of the American Farmland Trust, John Scholl grew up on a farm in McLean County. He says small-acre operations like Prairie Earth Farms are becoming more common.
So I have seen, you know, a lot of operations that have converted into, you know, direct consumption markets, providing food and our fruits and vegetables to institutions, hospitals, schools, that sort of thing. As well as getting into things like agritourism.
Agritourism opens up farms to city folks who are willing to pay money to spend a day or sometimes a weekend living and occasionally working on a small farm. For people who otherwise wouldn't have a real connection with the earth, Scholl says it provides an opportunity to get back to the land. Heather Wilkins is with the Land of Lincoln Regional Tourism Development Office. She says most ecotourists like to travel an hour or so from home to experience rural life. For some, Wilkins says, such visits are traditions.
Taking pictures every year as their child gets older, picking the grand pumpkin that's going to be on their porch. It could be outings going to the wineries every year, especially the Southern Illinois, the Shawnee Wine Trail, that have beautiful accommodations ranging from cabins to bed and breakfast.
A key to sustainable agriculture is financial as well as ecological. John Scholl of Farmland Trust says all farmers have to balance the bottom line with environmental concerns, especially growing monoculture crops of corn and soybeans. But Scholl says organic and agritourist operations also have a place. As cities expand, he says smaller niche farms spring up in newly developed areas.
If you look at where land conversion is taking place, in other words, land being taken out of agricultural production and put into, you know, housing development or roads or whatever, that quite often is on an urban edge where you have quite often smaller parcels.
Hans Bishop of Prairie Earth Farms hedges his bets on organic farming through community-supported agriculture or CSA members. Prairie Earth has a sizable group of 64 CSAs who make things a bit more predictable, according to Bishop.
Kind of helps us make it through the wintertime, you know, when we're not able to grow as much stuff. And, you know, just helps us, you know, pay the bills that are coming for the next season.
Sustainability and diversification could be the keys to smaller farms in the future. And a sampling of visitors to the Bloomington's Farmers Market shows an increased awareness of and demand for organic and other locally grown crops.
Locally grown food that tastes a lot better than most of the stuff that you get in the supermarket that's been trucked from sometimes thousands of miles away.
Fruits are juicier. It just, you can tell that it's been picked recently.
I don't eat tomatoes that come out of the grocery store, only if they're from my own plants or from here. And so I'm here to get good tomatoes.
Andy Zeal of Prairie Earth Farms is at the farmer's market, too. He's surrounded by a wide variety of just the kind of tomatoes she's looking for.
Prudence purple, they're like a pink heirloom, have a good kind of tart, sweet flavor. Then there's striped German, which are yellow with like some blotchy red spots. So some people's favorites. Those are called Valencia. think probably because they look a little like oranges.
Zeal says people are very interested in where food comes from, how it was produced, but he says the most important thing is taste.
People can shop for, you know, other reasons, but if it doesn't taste better than what you get at Walmart or something, then it's not going to last.
Just a half block away is an information booth for Green Top Grocery, which is hoping to open up in the Twin Cities to sell locally grown products. So the future of sustainable agriculture may well look like its past. Small, family-owned farms selling the food they grow to people who live in the area. I'm Jim Brown.
Despite Greece's economic downturn, the cupcake business is doing well in Athens. Hampton's Cupcakes American owner has some beefs with the bureaucracy, but remains optimistic about the country in which she chose to develop her business. She recently opened her third bakery. NPR's Jim Zaroli has this report.
The Greek economy may be limping along, but business is pretty brisk at Hampton's Cupcakes in Athens. The tables in the sunny courtyard are filled with customers sipping Greek coffee and eating American cupcakes. People like Chris Papadimas, a student.
It's something fresh here in Greece. It's something tasty. If your coffee is just black, it tastes even better.
Hampton's Cupcakes was started by Nicole Katovis, a 37-year-old former TV producer from New York. A few years ago, she wanted to make a change in her life. A Greek-American herself, she figured Greece might be open to the cupcake fad. She got here just as the economy was tanking.
The Greeks tell me, they're like, oh, if only you had been here in the better times. I mean, you came at the worst time. What were you thinking? To this day, I hear, thank God you have an American passport. You could just get up and leave. Why aren't you doing it?
But Katovas persisted, and today she's just opened her third store. The decor is very Martha Stewart, with glass cake dishes stacked on white wooden shelves. The menu is on a chalkboard, and there's a window where you can watch the baking. When she started, Katovas had to teach her employees how to bake American style. And she had to tweak the recipes.
It was almost a three-month process until we actually came out with a cupcake that could withstand the climate here. Mm. And we change it a little bit in the summer. We keep it very cool inside for obvious reasons. But it's working.
Understanding how to do business in Greece was trickier. For example, Greece has its own unusual system of financing. As a business owner, she can write checks to suppliers or contractors and post-date them. The suppliers can't cash them right away, but they can use them as collateral for a bank loan.
It's a very different policy here. It works great if you're building up a company.
So it's a kind of form of credit almost.
Almost.
This kind of financing has become much harder to get recently. Like other Greek businesses, Hampton's Cupcakes has to pay cash for everything it buys now. Katovas has also had to get used to Greece's strict employment laws. Her workers have guaranteed wages and benefits, including 4 weeks of vacation. And every Christmas and Easter, they get an extra month's salary as a kind of bonus.
I said, next life, I'm coming to Greece as an employee and America as an employer.
That's the Greek way, and Katovas doesn't really complain too much about the regulations. What does frustrate her is the way the rules change. One day the government demands a certain kind of permit. The next day it wants something else. It's confusing, and she says a lot of Greek businesses develop a kind of casual attitude toward the rules.
For better or for worse, they sort of figure ways to do things legally, but with the least possible effort is the best way I can say it, the most diplomatic way I can say it. For example, there are many stores that operate without actually having full permits, which eventually they have to get, but they haven't been able to yet.
For all the troubles, however, Katovas remains a big booster of Greece. There's a lot of native business talent in the country, she says, and she's convinced the economy can recover.
They definitely haven't reached it, and they're probably not even close yet. But I constantly have this positive thought that it will, it'll happen. And that's what I love about it.
Meanwhile, she's trying to show that new businesses can survive and grow in Greece, even in the midst of a long and very painful downturn. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 4th of October, 2012. It's the birthday of Edward L. Stratemeyer, Elizabeth, New Jersey, 1862, one of the first American writers to capitalize on the new market in children's literature, which was created by Universal Primary Education. At the time, most books written for children were little moral lessons, but Edward L. Stratemeyer decided to write adventure stories with recurring characters. He wrote The Bobbsey Twins. He wrote a series called The Outdoor Girls, another called The Motor Boys, later The Hardy Boys, and then a series about a girl detective named Nancy Drew. It's the Nancy Drew books that were the most popular that Stratemeyer ever published. He created one series after another, and there was such a demand for the work that he created the Stratemeyer Syndicate. He wrote the outline for each story himself, and then he hired fiction writers, dozens of them, to bang out the actual books under a variety of pen names. Kept writing until he died in 1930, and then his two daughters took over the syndicate. One of them, Harriet, wrote a number of Nancy Drew books. It's the birthday of Roy Blunt, Jr., born in Indianapolis, 1941, raised in Decatur, Georgia. Freelance writer for more than 100 different publications, author of more than 20 books. His latest, Alphabetter Juice, or The Joy of Text. Roy Blunt, who said, "Language seems to me intrinsically comic. Noises of the tongue, lips, larynx, and palate rendered in ink on paper with the deepest and airiest thoughts in mind and the harshest and tenderest feelings at heart." It's the birthday of Damon Runyon, Manhattan, Kansas, 1880, known for his distinctive stories about New York street life, written in vernacular, most of which Damon Runyon created in his own head. It's the birthday of the comedian Buster Keaton, born in Piqua, Kansas, 1895, to vaudeville comics. The boy became part of the act when he was just 3 years old and got big laughs being thrown around, taking falls with a very serious look on his face. He created a deadpan style that was not as popular as Chaplin's Little Tramp character or Harold Lloyd's optimistic young man in the suit. But he made some great movies, The Navigator and The General and The Cameraman, in the mid-20s. Here's a poem for today by David Wagner, The Escaped